Welcome to the Times of Israel's Daily Briefing. Today is Monday, April 8th, day 185 to the war with Hamas. Amanda Borshel Dan here with our Zman Yisrael editor Biranit Gorin and reporter Kanan Lidor. Thanks for joining me.
Hi, Amanda.
Good morning.
We're hearing conflicting reports regarding the potential hostage release deal negotiations. Bira will fill us in. Kanan is here to update us on where those Israelis who were evacuated from their homes during the war are now. We'll hear about how Shas rabbis are spurning a compromise on the issue of Haredi enlistment, and we'll hear thoughts from Bira on the state of Israel as we mark 6 months of war with Hamas. All this and much, much more when we're back.
The Technion Israel Institute of Technology is where some of Israel's brightest minds ask the biggest question of all. What if? What if they could take on the world's biggest challenges? What if they could develop life-changing environmental, scientific, health, medical, and technological discoveries that will make a huge impact on Israel and the planet? But they don't just ask the question, they answer it too. They turn those ideas into reality. They make them happen. To see just some of the incredible things they've achieved, get the Technion Booklet of Wonders at ats.org/wonders. We hope it inspires you to give them your support so they can keep doing what they do best. The American Technion Society. World-changing discoveries by Israel's brightest minds, made possible by you.
First, some headlines. The IDF says it eliminated a senior field commander in Hezbollah's elite Wadwan force in an airstrike in southern Lebanon overnight. The IDF also says it struck three Hamas rocket launchers that were placed adjacent to humanitarian shelters in southern Gaza's Khan Yunis and were used in attacks on southern Israel. Iran's foreign minister is on his way to visit Syria's capital, Damascus, a week after a strike blamed on Israel that killed seven of its Revolutionary Guard commanders in a building adjacent to the Iranian embassy. Iran has vowed to avenge the deaths, with a senior advisor to the supreme leader saying on Sunday that Israeli embassies were no longer safe. Bira, this morning, Israeli and Palestinian officials have downplayed reports that a truce and hostage release deal between Israel and Hamas could be reached as early as this week. But a senior Egyptian official that was cited in Egyptian media said that, quote, significant progress on several contentious points of agreement have been made. So what are you hearing, Bira?
I'm not hearing anything particularly different than what you just said. I mean, there's conflicting reports. There's some difference between the reports that we're getting if we're talking to American sources, for example, as opposed to talking to Israeli sources. So the Americans are more optimistic, I would say. There's a sense for them that there has been some progress made in the negotiations, and they are optimistic that something can be reached. There's a Haaretz is quoting, as of now, a foreign diplomat saying that we will know by tomorrow evening, that this is probably the time we will know if we're facing a deal or if everything breaks down. I think for the most part, what we need to look at, if we want to be a little bit more complex about it, is the roadmap that Biden, President Biden, has laid out in his conversation with Netanyahu towards the end of last week, following the killing of the seven employees of the World Central Kitchen. So we know now that in this conversation, he pretty much laid out a list of requirements, and we're seeing them actually play out one by one in the last couple of days. So in that respect, we have some sense of idea where we're heading. So he required Netanyahu, he demanded that Netanyahu opens the Ashdod pier, which Netanyahu immediately that day announced they are going to do. He required that the Erez crossing to Gaza will also be opened for humanitarian aid, and that has also been done as of yesterday. He required that the IDF will open a central HQ for the protection of humanitarian aid workers in Gaza, And Netanyahu has already told the army to start working on that. We also saw the troops pulling out of Gaza as of yesterday from Khan Yunis. So essentially there are fighters there. There's the Nahal Brigade that is still there, but it's more on a patrol keeping work in making sure that there's no crossing from the south of the Gaza Strip to the north of the Gaza Strip. But in effect, right now, there's no boots on the ground that is continuing the fighting. So, you know, that was done. And we know that this was something that both Hamas actually required as a term for their ongoing negotiations. So that's been done. It hasn't been announced. Nobody came up and said on the news, that's it, the war is over, or we're stopping the war. But in effect, that's what they're doing. And obviously, Biden also required Netanyahu to get to a negotiations and sign a deal with Hamas. So there's a few other things, but we're seeing them playing out. So that kind of raises the idea that if one of those terms was, you got to sign this, you know, you can't have it all. You can't continue to fight in Gaza. You can't have the Rafah operation that you want and get the hostages back. And therefore, you got to sign it. Then maybe this is what we're seeing play out right now. I don't think Netanyahu will ever admit to being told what to do and having to do it. But I think the ultimatum that Biden has given him in saying, if we don't see this happen, we're going to stop supporting this war, is too crushing and too big for Netanyahu to not follow up on. So he's going to say that we're an inch away from total victory and all those things because it's important both for his own political survival and for possibly the morale of the soldiers and the Israelis to believe that they're on the path to victory. But in reality, right now, things are playing out exactly as Biden had asked it to play out.
Right. I just want to also mention, you said nobody has announced the end of the war. Quite the opposite, that our chief of staff, Herzi Halevi, is announcing this is not the end of the war, but clearly this drawdown of troops is sending a very strong message to Hamas that, yes, we are ceding to some of your demands. But as you mentioned, this is very tricky politically, and I wonder how it's being received by the cabinet or the government in general.
The two usual suspects, I would say. So Bezalel Smotrich, the head of the religious Zionism faction, has announced an emergency meeting of his faction to decide what to do. So we don't know yet. He hasn't made an official reaction. But Itamar Ben-Gvir, the head of Otzma Yehudit, he's been very consistent in opposing any kind of deal that would require either stopping the war or freeing terrorists from Israeli prisons. So he's already announced this morning that if this war has now stopped, then Netanyahu doesn't have a mandate to continue being the prime minister, meaning he's going to break down the government. I do have to say, though, I'm not sure that just like in the previous negotiation or in the previous deal that saw the release of over 100 Israeli hostages in November, I'm not sure that Ben-Gvir can follow up on this ultimatum, because in the case of a hostage deal, first of all, this is exactly why Gantz is still in the government. Benny Gantz is still in the government and not withdrawing as everybody expects him to, because he knows that he's needed in order to get the hostage deal done. And second, I think Yair Lapid and the opposition has already said that in this case, they will give Netanyahu the backing that's needed to carry out this deal. So as far as votes in the Knesset goes, Netanyahu doesn't really need Ben-Gvir and Smotrich. However, we do know that if for his own safety and for his own survival, I say political safety, and for his own survival, if he doesn't want to end up going to an early elections, then he does need them, obviously. So this is going to put Netanyahu front and center in his very real dilemma of what comes first. And for the past 6 months, this has been a dilemma that has been playing out in front of our eyes. A survey that was run yesterday on the Channel 12 News, which is our biggest channel showed that 56% of the population believes that Netanyahu is factoring political issues rather than just thinking about the hostages or the greater good. So that means that there's no confidence, you know, there's no confidence in the fact that he's doing his utmost to free the hostages. And we will see this play out now. At some point, he will have to make this decision. Perhaps it's going to be as near as this week.
We'll go to a short break.
I got married this Monday in the middle of a war.
You are not a soldier anymore. You are 50 years old. What is the matter with you?
It's like a couple of kilometers from here. Like, my friend has a 4x4. Let's just go cut across the fields and go get him.
Israel Stories, Wartime Diaries. Voices that try to capture slivers of life right now.
And he told me, take with you a sleeping bag and a tent and just go.
I texted him on, like, after I was told that he was killed.
From their eyes, I was a traitor.
Everybody needs their, like, blankie, their teddy bear, something to make them feel safe.
I'm just another grandfather looking after his grandchild while his son is off at war.
These children of Hamas now will be the killer of my children.
I desperately wanted to talk about sex during my eulogy for Ido.
Everyone has to choose to be optimistic because we don't have room for pessimism.
Check out Israel Story wherever you get your podcasts.
And we're back. Kanan, 6 months after the Hamas onslaught on southern Israel, 70% of those who departed the affected area have returned to their homes, or at least to the area. The government released some data yesterday. So can you bring us some more numbers? What is happening in the Gaza envelope area and the region in general?
So that's the good news, that 70% are back 6 months after October 7th. In terms of statistics, you have about 7,000 people living in hotels still, mostly in the Dead Sea area and in Tel Aviv and Jerusalem. And you have another 2,000 who are staying at alternative housing solutions, like apartment complexes that have been cleared for them in other communities. You have, for example, in Kiryat Gat, you have Nir Oz are staying in 6 residential apartment buildings that had not been populated yet, so they put them there. There are other more palatable solutions for kibbutzniks being constructed right now. For example, in Omer near Be'er Sheva, they're supposed to absorb kisufim, one of the kibbutzim that have been seriously damaged in the attack. And that's really the dichotomy. You have about 13, 14 communities that have been either too severely damaged on October 7 or are currently deemed to be at an elevated risk, too elevated to be repopulated. And that's the bulk of the evacuees from the south who are still living as displaced, internally displaced people. And of course, you have another 60,000 evacuees from the north that are in hotels and apartment complexes and accommodations indefinitely. They have not been encouraged to return yet because, of course, we're still bracing for the big one with Hezbollah.
So those who have returned, is it mostly the older couples, that kind of type of person? Because I imagine it would be very difficult to uproot a family with a whole school system and things of that nature and return in midstream. I mean, we're right before the Passover holiday, but the semester is well underway.
Actually, it tends to be the older persons who remain. The families with the children, they are much more eager to return because the children have been separated from their natural social environment. So they are eager, they are pressing the parents in many families I've spoken to return. And the older persons, some of them traumatized, and some of them really are not so embedded in their communities, in their greater communities, that they want to return. They have some friends at the hotel, and that's enough for them. You can see them playing Scrabble on the lobby floor. They have the routines already in the hotels, I mean. And so they're much more institutionalized.
Also yesterday, 18 prominent rabbis associated with the Shas Party and the ultra-Orthodox Sephardic movement signed onto a document rejecting any compromise on the conscription of Haredi Jews, including those who are not studying in yeshivas. And I personally find this a bit puzzling because we know of several prominent Shas politicians, at least, who served in the past, as well as some of their children who very publicly joined during this war effort. So what's happening here?
Now, you're not the only one. This seems to have surprised many close observers of Shas. And that's because our image of Shas is of being much more ingrained, much more connected to broader society than their Ashkenazi Haredi counterparts in bubbles, essentially, in Jerusalem neighborhoods, Elad, and those kinds of places. That's because they have bigger families, often, and because of a Sephardic tradition of observance alongside pragmatism, you might say. To put it in concrete terms, the from Haredi, zealous Shasnik has a cousin who serves in the IDF and prays for him every day. And that's not necessarily true for many of their Ashkenazi counterparts in Haredi enclaves. And that reality is observable on the political level. You see Yanki Deri, one of the sons of Arya Deri, enlisted at 40 to the IDF. He has a department at the World Zionist Organization. So he enlisted. It's kind of a PR move, but, you know, that's where the symbolism lies, in November to the IDF. That's unimaginable for Haredi politicians of Deri's caliber on the Ashkenazi side. And so when these 18 rabbis yesterday came out with this letter, very, very extreme, very radical letter that basically says it's better to die than serve in the IDF, to give our souls. It can be interpreted also as devotion, but also as to die in order not to go to the army or to go to prison. That's stated very clearly. That even Haredis who are not yeshiva students should be exempt from the draft, which kind of diverges from the Shas line up till now. And so it exposed an internal division or difference of opinion between the spiritual leadership of Shas, who tend to be older people in their 70s and 80s, and the political leadership, younger, more pragmatic people. And we haven't really seen this division in such clear terms until now.
Kanan, thanks for bringing that update. I'll let you go. I know you have a busy day.
Thank you.
Bira, in parts of North America today, people are getting together for a solar eclipse watch party, including my family. And anecdotally, I took three of our children to Turkey. So I don't know, almost two decades ago to experience this phenomena. It's fantastic. So I'm wondering, have you ever experienced a full solar eclipse, Bira?
Well, I thought about this, that I've actually never, for whatever reason, I've always been at the wrong place at the right time. I've never actually witnessed a solar eclipse, a real solar eclipse myself. But thinking about it, I feel like for the past 6 months, I'm witnessing a proverbial or metaphorical solar eclipse right here in Israel. My impression of solar eclipse, and you'll correct me if I'm wrong, is that the one thing you don't want to do is look straight on into it without some kind of eyeglasses or protection. And if you do, it burns you. It literally burns you and could even have a long-term effect. I think that's what happened on October 7th. You know, we were forced to look into our weakest moment in the history of the state of Israel, and it's etched a grief that isn't going away. I mean, once in a while this podcast catches me. You know me, I'm an optimistic person, I'm a happy person, but once in a while this podcast catches me in a point of weakness where I'm more somber, if you will. And maybe it's human nature when you reach some kind of a year site, you know, when you reach some kind of a milestone. So 6 months is a milestone. that you become more pensive and you look at it from a bird's eye view. Well, my bird isn't very happy. I think something that caught me yesterday in all the special reports and summaries and analysis of the 6 month mark, how much we're still in October 7th, how much we haven't really been able to move away from it by an inch. You know, it's quite incredible. And how time is weird, because on the one hand, it feels like it's been forever since it happened. And on the other hand, it feels like it was yesterday. So it's very confusing. And I don't think that anybody in Israel gone on to, you know, to has moved on. But I think for the most part, it's with us every moment of the day. It's everywhere. It's whether it's in the cemeteries, you know, it's whether it's in the very mere fact that we still have 133 people there. We know that at least 35 of them are dead, either murdered on October 7th or during the war in Gaza. But that still means that there is almost 100 people that are potentially alive, that are living in conditions that it is unfathomable and unbearable to think about. We know that because those that have been there and came back home are telling us those stories. And it's just unbearable. It's unbearable. And what's even more unbearable is the rift, the chasm within the Israeli society on how to go about moving forward, on how to go about fixing what was broken. I don't think that we have the answer for it, not from above, not from the government, and not from below, from the streets. Everybody has their own view on what should be done, whether it's the extremes that think that we should just wipe off, you know, the Palestinians and just conquer Gaza and, you know, and do what we did with the settlements in the West Bank. From the other extremism that says just stop all war, there's no more war, no more fighting, just, you know, sign some kind of a peace accord with the Palestinians. There is an array of options in between that nobody is making an assurance that this is what's going to happen. We have no plan moving forward. And reading about what happened on October 7th and unraveling more and more information about what happened that day, it's unsettling, I would say it this way. I think I keep telling this, and your listeners know this. I'm 57 years old. I was born right after the Six-Day War, like a month after, in Jerusalem. So I belong to a generation that the people say that they didn't know war in the sense that people of my age, when they went to the army, we no longer had existential wars. You know, after 1973, from 1973 backwards, all our wars were existentials. They were against countries with very large armies that could have conquered us and they could have wiped off Israel. From after 73, moving onward, Lebanese war, the two Lebanese war, they were in the face of factions, you know, Palestinian factions or whatever it is, the PLO, etc., Hezbollah. They weren't against a country with a military behind it, and it wasn't against several countries all at once. So we find ourselves now in a situation we haven't faced since 1973, which is, it does feel like an existential war. It does feel like when you look at October 7th, you know, the Hamas sent in 2,000 or 3,000 terrorists, and they were here to kill. They weren't here to conquer. They could have easily decided that they're here to conquer. They could have easily sent 2,000, 3,000 more terrorists in. As soon as they walked in and they saw that they're getting no resistance, they could have sent even a few more thousands, and they could have, you know, moved on. And just the way that they conquered army bases next to the Gaza border, they could have potentially conquered bases, you know, Air Force bases a few miles onward. So in a very perverted way, we were lucky. It's horrible to say this, but when you look at the big picture of what October 7th has unraveled, is that their choice to kill and not to conquer, in a way, is the thing that saved us from an even bigger tragedy, an even bigger war at our feet. And so the IDF, for the first time, is fighting on multiple fronts since 1973, both north and south, and in a way, the West Bank. It's fighting a war where the beginning of that war caught it so off guard that it's still working its way. It's not in its full forces and in a full clear head with commanders that know that they're going to be there for the long term. And on top of that, it has rifts and issues with the government. So we've never been in a situation where the Israel Defense Forces felt a little defenseless. And that's scary. I mean, it's an existential issue for the Israeli society that I think is going to follow us for a very long time forward. And in that respect, I'm thankful for the support that we have from the Americans. I think we're blinded. I think we're hurt from what happened, from our own solar eclipse. And I think the only kind of protection that we currently have is whatever support we get, and we have to remember that. We have to remember that we can't do this alone. We won't be able to face Iran and Hezbollah and Hamas or whatever it is. We won't be able to face it alone. We have to factor this in. We have to figure out that for our existential being, same as it was in 1973, it is today. We need the U.S. on our side, and we need the world on our side. And it's probably one of the most shocking aftermath of the October 7th is that within 6 months, we've managed to lose the world's support so quickly and so, I would say, almost frivolously. So I think I'm in that kind of somber mood, if you will.
Bira, thank you so much for your insights. And I really feel like this is a cry from your heart, and I appreciate your openness and honesty as well.
Thank you, Amanda.
Thanks for listening to the Times of Israel's Daily Briefing. Please check out another installment tomorrow. This episode was produced by The Podwaves. If you have any questions or comments about this or any other episode, please drop us an email to podcast@timesofisrael.com. Until tomorrow, shalom.